Broadcasting to New York City, Los Angeles, Chicago, Sydney, London, and around the world, this is Trumpet Radio Live.
Thanks for joining us here on Trumpet Radio Live, 101.3 KPCG, online at kpcg.fm, live link at thetrumpet.com as well. Coming up on the Monday edition, have you ever heard of false hope syndrome? Sort of interesting, might be affecting you. Interesting story to look at. Also, what is the point of polling anyway? They always ask people their opinions, and then it seems like it doesn't matter what they say. And you can't always trust them. We've got an article about that. And some think that a message to Garcia is outdated. Story about that. And more coming up on Trumpet Radio Live.
This is Trumpet Radio Live.
Thanks for joining us here on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG. And you can follow us on Twitter if you'd like to, at KPCGFM. Also, you can email us comments at kpcg.fm. We appreciate those coming in. I'm Dwight Falk, Grant Turgeon, and Abraham Blondeau here today on this Monday, which is quite a warm day, 90 degrees. I think it's our first up north of 90 day, potentially, well, this year, I guess, maybe since last summer.
Yeah, pretty exciting. Feels good out here.
I'm actually enjoying it somewhat. And we'll test the air conditioning today up here and see if it actually works. Because it gets spicy up in the studio if the air conditioning is not working. It feels good in the morning, and then it gets hot as the day goes on. One of the headlines today is kind of an ongoing story, of course. James Comey and Mike Rogers are testifying before the House Intelligence Committee. And so that's an ongoing thing here on Monday. And listen for analysis of those and other top headlines at the Trumpet Daily Radio Show and also at thetrumpet.com. You can see that. So once the dust all settles, I'm sure there'll be some really good analysis there. But they're testifying on what they've found. It's kind of an ongoing. You can check the blog, the live blog of what people are saying about it at CNN and other places. So this is kind of, I don't know if this is a culmination of all these accusations about Russia tampering and about the Obama administration hacking Donald Trump. They're talking about it today anyway.
Yeah, well, I think it will be good just to see what the intelligence community says, and then hopefully we can all move on with our lives. Because, I mean, if those accusations are true, they're pretty serious consequences for those individuals involved. But it'll be nice just perhaps get some real facts out there in the media, and then we can move on and actually get to some kind of basis for it or action points instead of just finger pointing for the last 3 or 4 months.
I always kind of wonder about the how much people believe what the intelligence community says, because they have been attacked over the years. Like, I think probably most famously with the Iraq, lead up to the Iraq war. You know, where they said, well, it was bad intelligence. There weren't weapons of mass destruction, which I think there were, and I think it's been proven since that there have been. They moved some of them. But so this is kind of presented like if the intelligence committee comes out and says something, like that's the final word on it. But I don't know. Do people even believe that? Can you believe that?
Yeah, and it's also like we're trying to ignore that anyone might have some sort of an ideological slant. Now when the media has betrayed itself and they've given away their own bias, and it seems like certain agencies are being used to politically target their opposition, you do have to consider as well what kind of motive they might have behind condemning the president or supporting him, whichever way it might be.
Yeah, I don't know if we've ever been real successful in the U.S. at this, but it seems like there should, you know, the hope is that they're like an impartial third party. Like they're not political and they're just looking for the truth and they don't care which way it comes out. But it's so everything is so politicized today. I just wonder if that's possible anymore, because it seems like everybody's picking a side.
Yeah, I think it's a lot more difficult today, especially. Well, it's been like that throughout the Cold War too, because especially the CIA wanting to do things against, like, the subvert communism, so they would support whatever government would give them the most leeway. So, in terms of, they don't necessarily support a person, they just want someone to give them the mandate they want or the authority they want. So there's been kind of that through American history, but today it's not, back then it wasn't necessarily ideology, ideology. It was more just whoever can give me the most authority, I'll side with them. Today, it's actually an ideology. They're kind of picking sides on who they want to be president, who they think is the best leader. And that really started, the Department of Justice was politicized under President Obama with the two attorney generals he had being very political and all those sorts of things. So I think it's what we're going to see is probably just more inconclusive statements where no matter what James Comey says, they're going to say, well, he tried to influence the election with the Hillary Clinton email right. thing, and he's probably just trying to influence people's opinions now. And so I don't know. I think the intelligence community is probably pretty trustworthy, still pretty honest for the most part. But it doesn't matter what they say now. Even if they're honest, no one might believe them, because if the media doesn't believe them, then
right.
a lot of people won't get the information they need.
There'll be a lot more analysis about that, I'm sure, in the Trumpet Daily Radio Show and thetrumpet.com. Also, the Trumpet Hour program, so you can listen for that in the days ahead. Speaking of the Trumpet Daily Radio Show with your host, Stephen Fleury, that was live from Edstone, England, 7 o'clock a.m. every Central Time, every Monday through Friday. Today, he talks about trade war is beginning as President Trump and Angela Merkel meet. Of course, they met on Friday. And a little bit of an icy situation, I guess. They didn't appear to be best buds, to say the least. And so as Stephen Fleury brings out in the Trumpet Daily Radio Show, there is a change in the trading going on in the world. Before Merkel went over, she talked to China, made sure they were on the same page. And so the U.S. is kind of positioning itself to be against the world in a lot of ways. And that's talked about on the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. So great program to check out, trade war and, not happy times between the U.S. and Germany, it appears.
Yeah, it was really awkward. I think a video clip was circulated on the news and social media where Donald Trump and Angela Merkel are sitting in the White House and they're like, do you want a handshake? And he completely ignores her and just kind of a really awkward exchange, weird looks at each other and, kind of like a childish. We don't know the full context of the meeting and everything, but even Donald Trump said that Germany owes America because we've been paying for their defense for so long. So pretty awkward, a lot of faux pas, not a lot of grace and that sort of thing. When you usually want to do that when it comes to diplomacy.
Yeah, the audio of that awkward exchange is played on the Trump Daily Radio Show where you can hear everyone in the press asking, handshake, handshake? And there's no handshake. So, and like you said, during that meeting or around that time, President Trump tweeted that Germany owes the U.S. a ton of money, NATO a lot of money, I guess the U.S. And from CNN.com today, Germany responds to that. They say Germany's defense minister has rejected claims from U.S. President Donald Trump that her country owes NATO vast sums of money, which isn't surprising. You wouldn't expect them to come out and say, right, you are, and here's the check. In a statement released on Sunday, Ursula von der Leyen said, there is no debt account in NATO to relate the 2% defense spending that we want to reach in the next decade solely to NATO is wrong. The defense spending also goes to UN peace missions, into European missions, and towards our contributions to the fight against ISIS terrorism. So they don't agree. They don't think they owe us any money.
It's hard to agree with that, though. It seems like America has definitely paid far more than anyone else. I don't know if we should necessarily pull out of that region just because they're not what they call paying their fair share. But definitely America has been shouldering the burden. There just happens to be a historical reason for that. You don't want to leave all of Europe in the hands of one nation.
Well, yeah, and in a lot of ways, we were sort of funding control of those areas, and we'd have a lot of say as to what happened there. And that's not a bad investment, but what we say isn't heeded like it used to be. And so at some point, there is diminishing returns on that. But what do? You pull out of Europe? We've mentioned it before, but Eisenhower said, I forget what the ratio was, but you know, every dollar you spend in Europe is worth like 50 here in the U.S. in terms of, you want to protect against Russia, places like that in Europe. You don't want to protect here. You don't want them coming to your door here. You want to protect it in Russia or in Europe. And so I think there's a lot of wisdom in that too.
Yeah, well, obviously you want to fight your enemies on their soil or close to their borders and not on your own borders. I think with America too, the big logic behind what President Trump is doing is that the American economy is in big trouble, and no longer can America spend huge amounts of money without any consequences. And so people are really criticizing his budget, spending too much on the military, cutting cultural funding and all that sort of thing. But the reality is America needs to make pretty significant cuts to a lot of things, or we're going to explode economically, go into economic Armageddon. So as much as the U.S. should still be a part of NATO, we can't afford it anymore. We can't afford to give people billions of dollars when in our own country, we can barely fund the government to keep going. Like every year, there's always the government shutdown because we can't agree on how much money for a budget. So I just think this is just the new reality of American politics where we have to make hard decisions. And just like the Roman Empire, you have to cut back on military expenditure on your far distant areas where you're funding military. So it allows your enemies to come in, or if you do fund that, your economy from the inside collapses. So it's pretty much an impossible situation.
Yeah, it's no win. It's a no-win situation because, as was pointed out on the Trump Daily Radio show, President Trump is correct in that a lot of the deals, trade deals, are unfair for us. But what's your option to make enemies of China, who we owe, make enemies of Europe, which is a huge economy there in Germany, to where they push back and they ally themselves together against us? You know, you want to talk about unfair, that'll be unfair.
Yeah.
And there won't be a lot you can do about it. So it is a no-win situation in a lot of ways. But there's a lot more about that at thetrumpet.com. You can check that out. We've talked recently about crocodiles in passing. They're scary, you know, and you don't want to get mauled by one. Australian teenager mauled after jumping into crocodile-infested river for a dare. Don't take that dare.
Yeah. I would more upset the person who dared him to do that in the first place.
18-year-old Australian youth is recovering after being mauled by a crocodile after jumping into a river for a bet. That was a bet, I guess. Same thing. He was apparently boasting about how he could swim in the dangerous waters in Johnstone River, North Queensland, at around 2:30 a.m. on a Saturday. Nothing good's happening at 2:30 a.m. on a Saturday unless you're sleeping. A saltwater crocodile known as... salty. That makes sense. Managed to grab his arm, but then he punched it and got away. He got hurt, but he'll recover. So that's what happens if you take a dare and jump in. You're going to get attacked.
Well, I wonder how much money he got. Maybe it was still worth it for him.
I don't know. It made me think about this past weekend. We went to one of the local parks here, and we had a nice little lunch or dinner with some friends. And we're sitting there at the table enjoying ourselves, and then this teenager awkwardly comes by, we don't know who it is, and sits at our table and just kind of looks at us all, and we're like, yeah. And then one of my friends astutely observed that it was a dare. He said, did your friends dare you to come sit over here? And he's like, yes. He walked away. So
that's fantastic.
Some dares are a little more harmful than others. But he didn't know us. You know, we could have mauled him, but we didn't. We just looked at him.
That must have been extremely awkward and uncomfortable for everybody.
It really was. You could tell he was, you know, he was kind of, you didn't, you know, we didn't know what he was doing.
He didn't say anything. He just looked at you.
Well, he kind of, and like he kind of came to the table and then kind of went away and then came, like he was kind of debating whether to do it. And then he sat down, just kind of looked at us. Really goofy look on his face, you know, and. Hey, how's it going? Or something like that. We're just like, what do you want? So somebody dared him. I think my friend saw like his buddies in the woods back looking at him like, you know, go do it, go.
Okay.
So it was like they were like having the dare weekend at the park apparently, and we were the victims.
Hiding out in the woods, huh? Formulating their plans.
And they kept doing it. They kept having different dares. So don't get into the dares. Stay away from the dares. Interesting. Have you guys ever heard of this false hope syndrome?
I've probably
had it a lot of times. I don't really know the definition.
It's a really interesting write-up. It's from the Washington Post. They give the example of a guy that's terrified of public speaking, which is, I think, the biggest fear that most people have. And he would get up to speak, and he'd start sweating really badly and, you know, feel sick and stammer, and, you know, kind of like myself right now. And so anyway, he wanted to overcome this, so he came up with a few thoughts. He would give himself pep talks beforehand. He started dressing in black so people couldn't tell he was sweating so much. None of it worked, and so he was very frustrated. And so what he did from that point forward was just kind of give up. Like, what am I going to do to overcome this? And they say this happens to a lot of people. That's the false hope syndrome. It's something coined by the University of Toronto professors Janet Pallavi and Cedar P. Herman. And basically, it's where you have a goal that you set. It could be anything. You know, I want to lose weight. I want to overcome my fear. But you don't accept what it takes to really get there. And so you kind of build this false hope. Like, if I do this one small tweak, it'll solve everything. It doesn't work, and then people quit. False hope syndrome.
And you say this from the University of Toronto?
Yes.
Well, I have some false hope right now. well, that makes sense because I think they got that from the Toronto Maple Leafs because they haven't won a cup in so long.
But yeah, it's. I mean, I think it's a really interesting point because that's kind of the society we live in, right? You know, hey, I want to be a Navy SEAL, right? I want to be fit like a Navy SEAL, so I just have to do this 5-minute workout every day, and that'll solve all my problems. Somebody tries it doesn't work, and then they quit. They're not realistic about the work it takes to accomplish the goal.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point, and I think that explains kind of the mentality of the generation that's coming up now, that they tell you to have hopes, inspirations, dream big, but they don't teach you the work ethic needed to get there, and or even teach you the lessons from men who did get there. A lot of their lives were pretty bad because yeah. They had to sacrifice a lot to get to their goals, to achieve their goals. So I think it's really a result of a lot of societal changes, lack of education maybe. But I think it's something we can all deceive ourselves or catch ourselves doing where I'm going to write a book.
Yeah.
This summer, and then you maybe write the title down. You're like, man, I just don't have time to do this, or I don't want to read, or I want to go outside and walk around, something like
right.
that.
Right. And the Bible talks about that, right? Counting the cost before you do something, saying, okay, what is it really going to take to get there? And am I willing to do what it takes to get there? Instead of thinking, you know, I'll just sit down and whip out the great American novel. Yeah. It might take a little more than that.
Well, the sad part about that false hope syndrome is that those small tweaks that you make normally bring about a positive result. It doesn't mean you're going to reach the peaks of greatest success, but you're still doing something that's worthwhile and helpful to you. Then the problem is people just quit when they don't achieve the extreme heights.
Right. Yeah. And probably you have to be realistic. Like, if I want to be in better shape and I'm going to, you know, do 10 minutes of exercise a day, you're going to get 10 minutes of benefit. I mean, you're going to get whatever the benefit is. It's not going to be the same as a bigger change. And so it's just really interesting. They give a couple of tips about how to work through that. I don't think they're great because it's all kind of psychology, I guess, in a lot of ways and talking about different things. But basically, I think the point's good that you do have to sit there and count the cost for anything you want to do. And then if you're willing to put forth the effort, stick with it and you'll see the results.
Yeah, don't quit. That's a really big part of that because obviously you're not going to change overnight either. It is going to also take some time. And so a lot of the time I bet probably people are thinking that the great, fantastic result is going to happen right away. That's just not realistic at all.
Yeah. So I thought it was kind of interesting that they examined it, but then it does get a little bit interesting in some of their thoughts. But there's a really good book, I think, that you could look at. Really two of them. I mean, 7 Laws of Success, that's free at thetrumpet.com, and How to Be an Overcomer. Both of those free at thetrumpet.com. They talk about how to have success, how to overcome bad habits, problems, things you want to get out of your life. It takes a little bit sometimes, but well worth doing. So false hope syndrome. I think we've all had that from time to time.
Definitely.
It does. You know, we all want to think that, boy, you know, I can just snap my fingers and make all these changes, and it doesn't always work that way. It never works that way, actually, that I can think of. You're listening to Trumpet Radio Live here on 101.3 KPCG. We're online at kpcg.fm, live link at thetrumpet.com as well. And you can follow us on Twitter if you'd like to at kpcgfm, and we appreciate your emails. Comments at kpcg.fm. Grant, you've got a write-up here from Breitbart, exclusive from Ann Coulter, who people find to be very controversial, I guess. As long as we live in a country where liberals are going to violently attack anyone who disagrees with them, what is the point of polling? What does she have to say?
Very long title, isn't it?
It is. I felt like yeah, it was half the article, right?
Yeah,
there.
that's her direct quote. They quoted an entire long sentence for the title there. But yeah, it was interesting. Breitbart interviewed conservative author and commentator Ann Coulter, and basically she just did make that point that, you know, a lot of these polls that are coming out are just so extremely skewed because conservatives are afraid of ever admitting that they're conservative, basically. There was a poll on CNN that seemed to indicate that 90% of Americans favor amnesty for illegals already in the country, basically letting them stay here and find a faster route to citizenship. If that is the case, though, Mr. Trump would have never been elected. So clearly there's some sort of skewing going on with these polls.
Well, even I saw Canada, another poll, but it seems maybe a little more realistic. 50% say they want illegals deported from Canada. And Canada's been held up as the bastion of let everybody come in, but not everybody feels that way. But if you were to believe the media, that's how everybody would feel.
Yeah, well, I think people are all for allowing people to come into the country, but legally. Because right. When they come in illegally, it destroys the whole system. And it undermines the people trying to do it legally. It completely undercuts their credibility. And it gets them grouped into like the negative side of things when they're not. They're trying to have a job. They're trying to support the country. And so with Canada, I'm not that surprised because I think Canada proves that immigration can work on a certain scale, but has to be done doing it through the laws and through the ordinances that are there. Otherwise, it will fall apart like any other countries.
Right, and so it's people probably feel differently than what the polls would indicate. But Grant, even in lead up to the election, a lot of people were saying they were going to vote for Hillary Clinton, and they actually didn't.
Mm-hmm.
And there was some follow up on that, and there was some intimidation. People didn't want to admit what they were really going to do.
Right, people did not want to answer on the phone that they were going to vote for Hillary Clinton. And Ann Coulter brings out the point that they didn't even want to admit that, or that they didn't want to admit that they were going to vote for Mr. Trump, I should say. And Ann Coulter brings out that these people didn't even want to admit that when it was an automated voice message that they were responding to. They didn't even want to tell the robot they were going to vote for Mr. Trump. So it does show you that we have kind of reached this point in the country where violence is the answer, it seems like. Violence is how people respond if they disagree with you. We've seen these huge mobs outside of really any place where a person they disagree with is going to speak. That is the consequence if you, I guess, speak out and use your right to free speech these days.
Well, nobody wants to be persecuted or attacked, even if it's just verbally. And so I think everybody kind of knows, though, in this climate, if you were to admit, say, that you didn't agree with every liberal idea, the list of names you'd probably be called. They're thrown out all the time. And in most cases, they don't know a lot about the person they're attacking, but they just throw all these really bad names at them. And that's intimidating. Nobody wants to be put in that situation. So I could see why people would be a little more quiet if they didn't agree.
Yes, it is rough because obviously the only answer that people will accept is that you favor open borders, you favor harboring illegals in these big cities or on these college campuses. That is really the only thing that people could say now to not face some sort of extreme pushback. And it used to be that obviously people would have some strong disagreements, but violence was never even hardly considered by anybody as a response to someone they didn't like.
Yeah, it's a strange climate because some of the violent outbreaks, whether it's actually, physically attacking people or breaking property or destroying property or just the words, it's accepted in a lot of ways now where, well, I don't agree, I'm protesting, so this is what I do. But that's mm-hmm. that's not a civilized society.
Mm-hmm.
You're supposed to be able to have different ideas and discuss them without it coming to violent action.
Right, and that also tied to an article from the National Review about how if we can't unite against rioting, then we can't unite at all. And it even brought out how I think it was the lieutenant governor of Berkeley or of California and the mayor of Berkeley after those riots against Milo Yiannopoulos both tweeted that hate speech is not welcome in their town or in that town. And then the only thing they could muster up to say about violence and rioting and beating people senseless in response to the supposed hate speech was violence is not the answer. So the speech is not welcome in the town, but violence is merely just not the answer. They're more appalled by speech they disagree with than they are by people getting seriously hurt.
Yeah, it's a really strange climate. And it's I guess it's happening because, again, it's not being really condemned. And it's kind of being fueled by the media in a lot of ways. You know, to where it's becoming the fashionable thing to be really pretty lawless in commentary and just even in actions. And, you know, it's like that dare we were talking about earlier. You know, your friends are all daring you to do something. That's kind of the climate. Like, go ahead. You know, you could do this. You could do that. It'd be so cool if you said this or said that. And it's peer pressure, but it's really a negative peer pressure.
Right. And that piece from the National Review also brought it out, too, that the media is trying to make it look like it's only maybe a dozen or so people who are violent, dressed in all black, covering their faces so that people they can't be identified. But the problem is even all of the so-called peaceful protesters out there will basically defend those people. So the violent ones will jump out from among them, assault their victims, and then jump back into the crowd, and the crowd will just basically form a wall and hide them in there. So even the so-called peaceful ones have been actually verbally cheering these people on and protecting them from getting found out and arrested by the police. That just shows you it's not just an extreme fringe movement. If you look at even pictures, overhead shots of some of these rioting instances, there's hundreds of people, like crowds of people all dressed in black. And so that even by itself would show you that it's not just maybe a dozen people.
Yeah, I mean, if you think about historically, it's a really scary thing to get into, because if you put out this message that whatever you're fighting against is, in this case, I guess it'd be conservatives on some level, or President Trump, or whatever they're fighting against. It can go either way, but that's the way it's going right now. It's if you say whatever we're fighting against is so bad, it's so terrible, then you begin to justify your own terrible actions. Historically, that's happened, and it's been a terrible thing. The most extreme example in modern times has been, of course, the Holocaust, right? Terrible actions, but it was justified in the minds of the people doing it, as terrible as that is.
Right, because weren't the Jews the cause of all the Germans' problems? That was sort of the line of thinking, that these people were so vile and so problematic, as is the word now, that you have to do something extreme to stop them. And that's even the case today, where people who are openly behaving like fascists, beating people up who they don't agree with, are calling themselves anti-fascists. That's just a core evil, to accuse your opposition of doing the exact thing that you are doing. That's what they're doing right now.
Yeah, really interesting. It's a sort of a climate of intimidation, one way or the other, and so it is hard to get a feel for what people really think, as this article brings out with polling, because you know what you're supposed to say if you want to, you know, be accepted by the loudest speakers, I guess.
You get a sense of that even with public figures, and the way that it seems almost uniform that they will speak out only if it is based on the popular narrative put out by the media. You hardly ever hear people speaking out in the opposite direction, even though tens of millions of people would also hold those beliefs.
Yeah. Really interesting write-up from Breitbart, exclusive Ann Coulter, and then her long quote, where she basically says, what's the point of polling if people are being intimidated? So really interesting write-up. And, of course, there's a lot more about that at the Trump.com, and particularly that article that was quoted there about what happened with some of the violence. That's one of the headlines from the Trumpet.com as well. Grant, thanks for stopping and bringing that to us.
Thank you.
You're listening to Trumpet Radio live here on 101.3 KPCG and online at kpcg.fm. Thanks for joining us here on this Monday edition. Abraham, you're a pretty funny guy. People think?
Sometimes.
I think you are. You're humorous. You've got a write-up here from the Economic Times. Why do we find jokes funny? Quantum theory might explain. The science, the math of it all, of good humor.
Yeah, this is really interesting because, obviously, humor is all something we strive for.
Unintentionally or intentionally, right?
Yeah, and sometimes we fly too close to the sun and we crash and burn with our humor, and everyone has a different sense of humor. Be sarcasm or puns and different. Everyone just has a different way of being funny. And so in at Toronto. The story's from Toronto, but it's actually researchers at the University of British Columbia in Canada. They're working on this quantum equation, this quantum model to explain why or how we find things funny, why we laugh at certain stories, at puns, at just weird things. What causes us, our minds, to have a comical reaction? And it's really interesting. And the word quantum, I think, confuses what they're actually talking about. And so this is talking about physics. And quantum, the word means basically it's the least amount of physical interaction inside of something. So in layman's terms, it's the smallest amount of a physical action. So for humor, it's what's the smallest amount of activity your brain does to find something funny. That's basically what the quantum means.
It's like the baseline for it, and then it builds off of that.
Yeah.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah.
So what they've found is that when they read different jokes and they were breaking them down, and they found that basically for a joke or a punchline, if you told just one part of the story, if you just told the punchline, if you just use like the word that's supposed to be funny, it's not funny by itself. It's just words, and people get confused by it. But it's everything put together is what makes it funny, they found. And that basically you laugh because you find your brain's able to recognize all these different parts of a joke, and it's understanding the differences is what makes it funny. So it's when you're telling a story about something extraordinary that happens, or suddenly the story flips and you misunderstood something and it's really funny. You find it funny because your brain recognizes all these different events going on, and then it can reconcile them. And then that difference is what they think is causes the comical reaction, causes the laugh.
It's strange that they're spending their time looking at it, but I guess it may. Yeah, if you could find the perfect a formula, then you could make a lot of money as a stand-up comic, right?
Yeah, you could just be a monotone professor. Stand up there and just say your equations and or the jokes in your equations that people should laugh all
right.
day. I mean, that's what I try to do as an instructor, but it doesn't seem to work.
You know, it's got so much to do with feel and timing, and it has to be at the right time and it has to be delivered in the right way. And it seems like when people are trying, they try to be funny. Like I'm going to be funny. It seems like it doesn't work as well, as opposed to just it naturally occurring. And so it is interesting. I think we've all experienced that over the years where somebody gets it in their head, like I'm going to be funny. Like this is my new thing. And then they go about trying to do it and it just doesn't work. And it ends up actually being very funny, but not as they're hoping.
Yeah, exactly.
Awkwardly funny. Yeah.
Well, yeah, I think, it's interesting that they're trying to do this, but I'm not sure if they've actually hit the nail on the head or if you can actually quantify something like humor. That is so vast, and we don't understand where even science can't explain where our brain power comes from in the first place, like why we're so different than animals. I'm not sure they can explain why we can have humor and animals don't, like what's the quality behind it. So it's interesting. I think there's some merit to it explaining through science why we do it, but I'm not sure if they actually can fully quantify, because if you talk to someone, there's so many different things that can be funny, so many different ways to be funny that I'm not sure if they can fit it into a neat equation.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I mean, when you stop and think about it from that perspective, it just highlights how amazing the mind is, human spirit and man.
Yeah.
It just does all of these things that are hard to put down in some sort of mathematical equation, simply. It's true. I mean, I guess I hadn't really thought of that before, but animals don't laugh. I mean, that's pretty obvious, but...
Except for hyenas, I guess.
Yeah, right. But I just, I mean, they don't. They don't do anything. I mean, they do things, but you don't see them laughing about something. And that's pretty obvious point, but I guess I never really thought much about that.
Yeah, I hadn't either until I started reading this, that in the physical world, everything's governed by physical laws you can observe. But with humor, like emotions, they're irrational. A lot of them are, or they can be. Where you just don't, you can't really explain why someone feels that way, why they're thinking. It's so complex, you can't, even that person sometimes doesn't can't explain why they feel that way. So, and even with humor, it's something as simple as like laughing, feeling good, like it makes you feel good and you feel relaxed and you feel camaraderie with people, like you're having a good time. That humor, it's, you can make you relax. It can even help you when you're on your deathbed, like when you're in these really serious situations. It can alleviate the stress that would otherwise maybe like break your the nerve of your mind, that kind of thing. So with humor, it serves a lot of functions. And if you view science and everything that there's an intelligent designer behind it, you can start to see why we even have humor. What's the point of it? It seems frivolous. It doesn't, some people make money from it, but it doesn't help you. It does help us with life and with our jobs and that kind of thing, but it's not an essential function. So why do we even have it? And I think when you look from the point of an intelligent designer, you can see it's just a gift that helps us have a much better life than if we wouldn't have it.
Yeah, it's enjoyable. It's kind of like a pressure relief valve in some ways. Like you said, you know, sometimes you get a little tense about something or anxious, and laughing really helps you feel better all around. And yeah, that is really interesting how that does work. There's a great book at thetrumpet.com, What Science Can't Discover About the Human Mind. It's really worth looking at. When you really stop and it's interesting when they try to break some of this common stuff down. Humor is a very common thing. They try to break it down and figure out how it works exactly. That's very hard to sum up. And it does, again, if you point back to an intelligent creator, it just shows the brilliance of that creation. You know, man can make machines that do things and that kind of, you know, make choices, I guess, either a one or a zero, right? But to laugh and the nuances and things like that, it's pretty amazing.
Yeah, just, babies laugh, even when their mind's not fully, they don't really understand anything yet, and they can laugh. Mm-hmm. And
they make us laugh, too.
Yeah, exactly. And we can't, it's one of the basic functions of human life, one of the basic emotions we feel, I guess, if you can put it that way. And scientists still can't explain the basics of why we are human, what differentiates us from animals. But we can do all these other amazing inventions and explain like the universe and all these as much as we can. But we still can't explain the basics of why we are human, why we are the way we are. And I think that should help us see that maybe we need to look somewhere else for the answer other than ourselves.
Right. Yeah, that's kind of the two base things that a baby's born with, right? The ability to cry and laugh.
Yeah, and eat.
And then eat and sleep and all that, of course. But yeah, that's what they do. They can't speak, obviously, so they cry and they laugh.
Yeah.
that's kind of what they do, or they just look at you.
Yeah.
One of three possibilities there.
Yeah, I have a couple curses in my life. One is people falling asleep on me while I'm in an airplane.
Yes.
We talked about that. The other one is babies just stare at me awkwardly,
mm-hmm.
like they're plotting something against me. So I'm not sure what I've done to babies, and maybe they sense that I don't really care for them too much. Maybe
is that what it is?
I like kids, but I'm not. I don't go crazy over babies. I'm like, looks like a baby. Like when I have my own kids, and like my sister had her first kid this year.
Yeah,
I haven't seen him in person yet, but I'm sure when I interact with him, I'll lighten up a little bit. But I don't go crazy over babies, and maybe they feel the same way about me.
They understand that, yeah, you're not on board yet. Yeah. That's really, really interesting right up there. Why do we find jokes funny? Quantum theory might explain, but they're not doing a great job of it. you have another write up here that's very interesting. I think a lot of us have probably read this over the years. I haven't read this in a while, but message to Garcia. This is a write up from the Modern War Institute. They say, an outdated message to Garcia, why Hubbard's essay needs to be shelved for good. That's their take on it. I read some of the comments, and quite a few of the comments didn't agree with that. So different opinions there.
Yeah, this is the Modern War Institute's at West Point, and this website publishes a lot of articles from officers and the people who are in charge of teaching and shaping the curriculum of how they train U.S. officers. And this particular one, it's actually two officers who co-authored this. They think that when you're training young military officers, that they need to get rid of Albert Hubbard's essay because it doesn't make any sense today in the modern military world and really in life in general. And that it's an interesting point because I think Message to Garcia is one of those things most young people read to kind of get a feel of taking the initiative, getting the feel of how to be, why you need to be a hard worker. And it's Albert Hubbard's most famous work. Most people only know him by that title. And it's just in case you haven't read it in a while or haven't read it, it's about Garcia was a general during this Cuban Revolution. And America backed Cuba against Spain. And the president needed to deliver a message to Garcia, but he had no clue where he was. He was somewhere in Cuba. So this young lieutenant named Rowan volunteers. The president gives him the message, and he doesn't ask how to do it. He doesn't ask where, when he needs to do it. He just goes and does it, taking the initiative and finding out how he did it. And actually, there's another story you can read written by Rowan. It's called How I Delivered the Message to Garcia. And it's exciting. People tried to assassinate him. He was dodging out of machete strikes and assassination attempts. It's a really exciting story, actually, to read that as well. But when you read about it, it's supposed to inspire independent thinking initiative. As Albert Hubbard said, don't be a vagabond wandering around the streets, threadbare, wondering where your next meal is going to be, cursing the world for your ill luck when you can't hold down a job and you're too lazy to stick with something long enough to be successful. And so these officers think that soldiers don't need to read a book that doesn't tell them how to get there. Because Hubbard doesn't tell them how to become like that. He's just saying you need to become like this at some point in your life. So they're saying it doesn't leave young men with a sense of how to get there. And it just kind of creates this moral ambiguity that they need to avoid.
Yeah, that's I don't agree with that. I guess probably a lot of people wouldn't. I've certainly have never been in the sort of training that they're going through. But, you know, just if you even think about anything in life, even a war or something like that. I mean, there are a lot of things that you know you need to do and steps you need to follow and so forth. But then there are always times where you've got to make a decision based on critical thinking. There's nobody there to tell you exactly how to do it. Life doesn't work that way. And you have to be able to, you know, take the initiative, figure something out. And then also know your bounds too, I think. You can go too far, I suppose. But there's always moments in life that come up like that. You know, you can't go to like, obviously you go to the Bible as your overall handbook, but it's not like every single thing is written out specifically. The principles are all there, but it's not like, you know, you can find that exact thing for yourself at that moment, probably in a lot of cases. And so you have to do some critical thinking and figure some things out and take some initiative. So that's kind of a weird point, I think, that they're making.
Yeah, I think they're in a military sense, they're just saying soldiers shouldn't accept a mission without asking more questions. Because that's a big part of Edward Hubbard's essay there, is that he should just go do it without asking questions. He's talking about those different assistants looking up the name Corrigio, who he was. That's one example. And that soldiers should ask more answers. They should ask how to do things and that sort of thing. But I think they miss a point in that if you look at any great military leader, most of them were pretty independent thinkers. And a lot of them were, they like Eisenhower, he couldn't ask someone, well, how do I defeat the Nazis? He had to figure it on his own. Who is he going to ask?
Google it.
Yeah, exactly. So I see the point they're making here. I don't agree with them at all. I think they're taking it too literal.
Yeah.
When it's just the principles of learning to be independent to an extent, and not not having any initiative at all, where you're always asking how to do something, so where no one can trust you with a task. And they really center on this quote by Hubbard from Amesha Garcia, and Hubbard wrote, "It is not book learning young men need, nor instruction about this and that, but a stiffening of the vertebrae which will cause them to be loyal to a trust, to act promptly, concentrate their energies, do the thing." And what Hubbard's saying is, I mean, book learning is great. He was very educated himself, but book learning is useless without character. And I think that's the whole point, is that you need character in order to be successful. Book learning can come along later, but if you don't have a stiff vertebrae, if you don't know who to trust, if you can't act promptly, if you can't do anything, then you're not going to be successful.
Yeah. There is no point in life where every little thing is laid out for you. But there are, I mean, there are obviously times you have to ask questions and stuff, and that's totally fine. Or even like we were talking about earlier, I mean, you have to really understand how at least you're going to go about a goal to some extent. you know, otherwise, if you have this false idea of how you're going to get there, you probably won't. So, yeah, there's times to investigate, to count the cost and all that. But at the same time, a lot of situations come up where there's not time for that. And you just have to make some decisions and go from there.
Yeah.
Particularly in a military situation. Well, you know, what if you're cut off from communication? You can't contact your superior or something, and you've got to decide what to do. That happens a lot, especially earlier wars, I'm sure. They have to just go and do something.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah, it's a great point, and I think most successful officers in the U.S. Army, especially many examples that popped in my head are Vietnam, when very chaotic combat situations where a lot of younger officers, like lieutenants who aren't, they don't make the big strategic decisions. They were cut off and they had to act on their own initiative to save their men, but also try to defeat the Viet Cong. That they're the ones who are celebrated. Those are the ones that they want us to learn from. Those who are independent, they're quick thinking. They seize the initiative when it's there. They don't overstep their boundaries. You can do that as well. You need wisdom, of course, in all things. But for example, if you're a boss. If you're a boss of a company, imagine having an employee that you have to walk them through every single thing you give them until they learn, which some things you should because they're very important. but eventually I think you want someone to say like, oh, go do this for me, and they can go figure out how to do it. You trust them to do it well, not to waste money or something. And I think that's the point of it all, is that whether you're in the military or on civilian street, you're in a civilian capacity, need to be able to make decisions on your own that support the end goal. Even when, like, I just got married 6 months ago. I ask for advice from people who have been married a lot longer than me on what to do. Mm-hmm. But sometimes I have to make a decision because that's my job, and that's I don't have time to ask for counsel. And so you have to know the balance between those two, I guess.
Yeah, some things are real serious, and you do need to get some good answers, and other times you just have to go and make your decision because it's not that big of a deal, and you've got to take some initiative on your own. Yeah, that is a really interesting point. I could see why they would maybe think that about a message to Garcia in some ways, but then, like you say, I think they're taking it too literally. And I would be very curious to know. I don't know the authors and necessarily what they're all involved in, but if they're instructing the people at West Point, some of them that come through, you know, how would they like it in their class if people just had, you know, ask constant questions? Well, how do I do this? How do I do that? I think eventually they'd say, okay, enough. You figure it out. I don't have to tell you every single thing about it. I don't think anybody likes that because you can't get anywhere. You can't get anything done then.
Yeah, exactly. I think as they make the point here, military is so complex today. Soldiers do need more training than in the past. They have to know how to interact with drones and these highly sophisticated weapons. So that makes sense. But at the same time, once they know how to do that, you have to cut them loose within their orders, of course, but you have to let them use initiative, use their training, prove themselves, because no leader can be successful unless he proves to himself and those who's following him that he is capable. You need that confidence and that success.
Well, think of how weak a military would be if once the top command couldn't contact them, they were completely inept. Like,
yeah.
Well, I don't know what to do.
That's happened sometimes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You would be completely worthless because all you'd have to do is knock out the top and everyone would just sit there.
Yeah.
Yeah. That would be not a good situation. Interesting write-up, though. A lot to think about there. And that's a good little book to read, Message to Garcia, essay, I guess. It's pretty short, but a really good lesson there. So maybe you pull that out and read it if you haven't before or if you haven't in a while. That's all the time we have for today on Trumpet Radio Live. Thanks for joining us here on this Monday edition. Make sure to listen for the Key of David program, Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Also, Music for Life coming up on 101.3 KPCG and online kpcg.fm. Have a great Monday. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
Listening to Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG.